listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
In 1972, Gloria Steinem and the co-founders of Ms. Magazine picked Wonder Woman to be the cover girl on their first issue, and I think we'll see a slide of that later. And Gloria Steinem recalled the thrill she felt as a child when she first encountered that buff Amazonian princess flying by invisible airplane from her sheltered island to help America in World War II. In her new book, The Secret History of Wonder Woman, Jill Lepore argues that all along, the superheroine has been a kind of missing link in American feminism. And as she explores that nexus of feminism and popular culture, she unpacks a revelatory chapter of American history. Her new book tells the feminist backstory about Wonder Woman's eccentric and inventive creator, William Moulton Marston, and the secret life he shared with his wife, Sadie Elizabeth Holloway Marston, and a younger woman, Olive Byrne, and how their abandonment of conventional identities helped lead to Wonder Woman's creation. We'll hear about that and much more in Jill Lepore's book, which not only overflows with ideas, it is, as graphic novelist Alison Bechdel called it, quote, as racy, as improbable, as awesomely righteous, and as filled with curious devices as an episode of the comic book itself. Jill Lepore is one of America's most esteemed essayists. She's an award-winning historian, Harvard professor, and New Yorker staff writer. Her work frequently explores unmined chapters of American history, or what she calls absences and asymmetries of evidence in the historical record. Among her many books, one that I'm loving reading right now, Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin, the youngest sister of one of our founding fathers, a smart, witty, a hardworking woman whom I'm sure you've never heard of. I hadn't either. And it contains one of my favorite sentences about a brother and sister ever. He loved no one longer. She loved no one better. Jill is just such a wonderful writer. Among other books, just to mention a few, as Jill is a veritable Wonder Woman herself, The Story of America, Essays on Origins, The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death, and The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution, and The Battle Over American History. And we knew that Alex Cohen was going to be the perfect interviewer for tonight after she sent us a photo of her daughter in her Wonder Woman outfit. And another great quality of Alex is that she is the author of Down in Derby, The Insider's Guide to Roller Derby, as well as being the fabulous co-host of KPC's Take Two show. And you've probably heard her as well before on All Things Considered. We welcome back Alex Cohen, and please join me in welcoming Alex and Jill Lepore. Thank you.
Thank you so much, everyone, for coming out tonight. I have to say I've done a number of these chats at Aloud, and I was never as excited as when I heard, would you like to talk with Jill Lepore about Wonder Woman? Yeah. And we're going to do that in just a moment, but my first question, Jill, please forgive, is not for you. It's for our audience. I would like to know how many of you out there grew up in some way, shape, or form, be it the comic books, the TV show, the animated TV shows, grew up with Wonder Woman and thought she was awesome. Well, of course. Thank you. Now, here's something interesting I found out today. Jill Lepore was kind of meh on Wonder Woman as a kid growing up. I was convinced it was going to be one of those, yeah, I had the Linda Carter
picture.
No,
I have no Wonder Woman cred.
Yeah, none at all. What was your thought on her growing up as you saw, you know, the Linda Carter version?
I had a crush on Patrick Duffy in The Man from Atlantis. Do you remember that? He was almost always nearly naked. He had the little yellow trunks, Speedo trunks on. So that's why.
Yeah.
I was distracted by the boy.
Well, and eventually you wound up distracted by another boy, another man, which is how you kind of wound up falling into this wonderful book, The Secret History of Wonder Woman, a guy named William Moulton Marston. And we just heard a little bit about him, but man, I mean, this guy is almost an amazing of a character as Wonder Woman, except he's real? Tell us more for those who haven't read the book yet. Tell us more about this guy.
Yeah, Marston is really endlessly fascinating. There's some kind of almost not an effort in American culture that he doesn't have a hand in the first half of the 20th century. He pretty much tries everything. And I love watching him over the course of his life move from one endeavor to the next. He once wrote this little essay about his life called The Experimental Life of William Moulton Marston, the kind of like Education of Henry Adams thing. His was really a life of experiments. So he tried everything and failed dazzlingly at each of these things. But he had this very bright start as a young man. He went to Harvard and right out of the gate was celebrated as a very great student, and he became devoted to the new field of experimental psychology's brand new field at the time, and decided to stay on at Harvard, got a law degree, then got a PhD in psychology. He, by 1923, when he was a very young man, he was widely credited as the inventor of the lie detector, what we would call the polygraph. He then embarks on this academic career as a teacher of legal psychology, but then that falls apart for reasons having to do with his strange family life. He then comes to L.A. in 1928. He's hired as a consulting psychologist for Universal Studios. They're trying to help think about the transition from silent films to sound films. Is in Hollywood for a few years, and then he ends up in comics. So he goes through science, the law, filmmaking, comic book writing, and in between, he's one of America's most celebrated pop psychologists.
He's a fascinating guy. What I liked especially when you write about the lie detector test was kind of how he really had to insert himself in everything. You know, it wasn't just the lie detector test. It didn't work unless he was administering.
Yeah. So during the First World War, the National Research Council, which is formed in the First World War, has a psychology committee, and Marston convinces the chair of the committee to found a subcommittee on the detection of deception to investigate whether Marston's important research done at Harvard could be used to interrogate spies and prisoners of war. And the other scientists say, well, it doesn't really seem to work. And so Marston devises a series of tests to demonstrate that it works. And the committee keeps saying, well, you need other people to administer the tests. And if it works also with them, then it works. It only ever works when Marston is administering the tests. And he just attributes this to the lesser talents of these other psychologists.
He has some very interesting, especially given the era in which he grew up, some very interesting attitudes and ideas about women, which of course are at the basis of this character, Wonder Woman. Talk a bit about those.
Yeah, well, there's two sources for those ideas about women, and in fact, they come into conflict with one another, and that's why there's such a kind of hodgepodge of ideas about women in Wonder Woman, and they really are in conflict with one another. So one source is Marston's work as a psychologist, and if you think about, this is the era he's training in the 19-teens, when Jung and Freud are still around and their ideas are gaining traction in the world of psychological thinking. And Marston has a set of ideas. He writes an important book called The Emotions of Normal People that is his philosophy. That is not meant ironically, I assure you. But it's his theory of emotions. And when you read it, you're like, this stuff is just crazy. Who would have believed that? But the reason it's important to kind of pull back from that and say, like, if Freud had gone nowhere or if Jung had gone nowhere and you just were to pull Freud's like case study of Dora or Jung on symbols and dreams or something off a shelf now and you had never heard of it before, you'd be like, who would have believed this stuff ever? This is nuts. Marston's work has that same quality, but there's a kind of freewheeling world of psychiatry and psychology in the 19-teens and 20s that he's really caught up in. And he comes to believe that women and men share a neuronal experience of emotions in which all emotions come down to four kinds of emotions: dominance, submission, captivation, and inducement, which is where all the bondage in Wonder Woman comes from. You will have heard the word, your ears would have perked up and said, dominance. So he actually believes that dominance and submission and captivation are essential to our experience of one another emotionally, and in particular, the experiences between women and men. So there's this sort of psychological origins of his ideas about gender, but also especially about sex. And that leads him in this, his one big sort of masterwork, Emotions of Normal People. It's an argument against the idea that there is an abnormal psychology. His whole idea in Emotions of Normal People is like anything you feel is neuronal, it's therefore normal. It inheres in your neurons, and you should learn to love the love parts of yourself, he says. It's really an argument for tolerance, really. And it's a kind of interesting manifesto in that regard. But he's someone who believed in sexual nonconformity. I guess historians would talk about that as an era of sex radicalism. So that's one set of ideas that he has, and it comes from his work as a scientist. But then the other is his work and his experience and witnessing of the suffrage and early feminist and birth control movements. So just to give you some refreshers about that movement, so Marston was born in 1893. He went to college in the fall of 1911, and that fall, the British suffragist Emmeline Pankhurst was invited by the Harvard Men's League for Women's Suffrage to speak on campus. The Harvard Corporation banned her from speaking on campus because women were not allowed to speak at Harvard. But she spoke in a nearby dance hall, and everybody went, and it was this incredibly stirring, rousing speech because Pankhurst had changed the suffrage movement, which had been going on for decades and decades and decades. Women had been fighting for the right to vote. But Pankhurst and her followers said, we're done just asking. Now we're going to really fight. And they were doing things like chain themselves to the railings outside 10 Downing Street and getting themselves arrested and going on hunger strikes and being submitted to force feeding, but making sure they were photographed when these things were happening. Incredible, incredible tradition of nonviolent and even sometimes violent resistance that Pankhurst brought to the United States, and Marston had front row seats for, as did his wife, who went to Mount Holyoke, which is a hotbed of suffragism. And the reason that Marston ended up leaving academia in the 1920s was that in 1925, when he was a professor of psychology at Tufts, he fell in love with a student who was a senior, whose name is Olive Byrne, and her mother, Ethel Byrne, is the first woman in the United States to be forcibly fed in prison. Ethel Byrne was a nurse whose sister was Margaret Sanger, who was also a nurse. And Ethel Byrne and Margaret Sanger opened the first birth control clinic in the United States in Brooklyn in 1916, and they were immediately arrested and sentenced to prison. And Ethel Byrne went on a hunger strike and nearly died, and she was the great hero of what became the birth control movement, which was really born in 1914 when Sanger and Byrne started publishing The Woman Rebel, which is an incredibly interesting feminist newspaper. The word feminism is used in that era for the very first time. It's not used anywhere before 1910, but by 1913, everybody's talking about feminism. So the very time when Marston was coming of age as a young person, and really as a young person interested in psychology, thinking about women and men, he was watching this incredible flowering of political activism on the part of women fighting for the right to vote, feminists who were fighting for a much bigger set of ideas about equality, and birth control activists. And then Olive Byrne, whom he falls in love with, moves into his household in 1925.
Even though he already has
he's
a wife.
Already married. He and his wife and Olive Byrne believe that they should live together as a threesome, come to believe that they should live together as a threesome. They raise their family together. It is a form of sex radicalism. But so there are two really different roots, in other words, for what Marston is thinking about women and men and women and power. When he creates Wonder Woman in 1941, her grandmother really is Margaret Sanger and the Woman Rebel from 1914.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's also interesting to see how that feminism kind of manifested itself at home, especially with this interesting relationship with two wives, and they had a number of kids between them. I mean, it's kind of like an episode of Big Love, and the first wife, not so happy at first when Olive Byrne comes along, but you realize it allowed her having another woman at home to help raise the kids meant that his first wife could go out and work. It was a kind of interesting form of feminism in itself, I felt like, within his own home.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many different ways to read that. I guess, you know, the test of any such arrangement would probably be, was it okay for the kids? Like, were people actually happy? We might really wonder. And I think there's mixed evidence about that. The kids all say it actually was kind of great. There were tons of adults around to love them. But Marston's wife was not pleased when he, as the family story goes, when he said, you know, I've fallen in love with this girl. She's 10 years younger than you are. She's a student of mine. He apparently said to her, I've met someone special and I'd like you to meet her.
That's when you run.
This is like not the conversation you really want to have. She's 10 years younger than you are. And but apparently his wife, you know, she went for this long walk for 6 hours and thought it over and came a long walk. But the thing that was really striking, I mean, the thing I've really worked on in this book, because I'm incredibly grateful to the Marston family who'd kept this story a secret for decades and decades and decades, and most of what I found out in the archives, like the archives of Harvard or DC Comics archives, the family never knew because the family was really cloaked in secrecy. But they were incredibly generous to look at like diaries and family letters and photo albums that no one had ever really seen before. And you do see a family that is really full of love. There's this wonderful moment later in life when Elizabeth Holloway is finally pressed to explain to the children who was sleeping with who. And she says, "There was lovemaking for all."
And this was well before 1960. It's pretty incredible to imagine. So now we know a little bit more about William Moulton Marston, but to truly understand the full story of Wonder Woman, I think it's important to understand the context, too, of what was going on in comic books at the time, for which I believe you've got a slide, maybe.
Yeah. I just thought you guys might want to see some comics. So this is the first drawing of Wonder Woman by the artist Harry G. Peter. This is from 1941. But to give you just a refresher course for those of you who are not comics geeks, comic books don't start until about 1933. There are comic strips before that that is like funnies that are in the newspaper, but they're not glued together and sold as books, which cost about 10 cents, until 1933. Sorry, I went back one ahead. The first comic book superhero is classically thought to have been Superman, who debuts in 1938 here on the cover of Action Comics with all of his powers in full glory. In 1939, Batman debuts, and Wonder Woman comes just shortly after in 1941. This is a cover from 1942. But what was important about the relationship among all of these superheroes, aside from the fact that they're all members of the
Justice
is that Wonder Woman is actually the antidote to Superman and Batman. Superman and Batman might not have been able to continue if Wonder Woman hadn't been published. Because what happened, imagine the creation of an entirely new art form, say, for instance, video games, that only kids really are interested in and only kids even really understand. Say, for instance, texting. and their parents don't really get it. Like, they're these cheap books that any kid can pay with. The kids have 10 cents to pay, and they trade this whole like a black market. And the storytelling, it's not like a book, it's not like a picture book, it's not like a movie. It's its own, it's a really interesting art form that's just emerging. And in it, a lot of people are killing each other and doing horrible things to one another. And there's tremendous danger and frightful events and there's terror. And a lot of them are much grislier than Superman and Batman. But there emerges by 1940 this incredible wave of anti-comics crusaders who are urging Americans to ban comic books and to burn comic books. And among their critiques is that Superman is a fascist, that he's a Nietzschean sort of ubermensch, that he's like a stormtrooper, that he's from a superior race, that he's like a demagogue. Children are supposed to worship him. This is, you know, looking across the ocean to the war in Europe and the rise of fascism. Meanwhile, Batman, when Batman started, Batman used to carry a gun. And Americans were pretty strenuously opposed to the private ownership of firearms in the 1930s. Indeed, so was the National Rifle Association, which supported the National and the Federal Firearms Acts of 1934 and 1938. There was a huge amount of anti-gun sentiment in the United States. And so here's this role model that children are supposed to be looking up for, who's actually more powerful than everybody, and it's like shooting people. So this is why the Batman's origin story is created in 1939, a few months after the initial issue, in which, oh yes, no, Bruce Wayne saw his parents get shot when he was a little kid. He hates guns, he will never use a gun again. That's where Bruce Wayne's origin story comes from. But the publishers of comics really were worried that comics were going to be basically shut down by censors. And so what would you do? Well, you would, of course, hire the world's most famous psychologist, the inventor of the lie detector test, the esteemed William Moulton Marston, to be a consulting psychologist and tell you what to do. And Marston has these kind of great ideas. Well, he says, you know, you need to We have this editorial advisory board. DC had already begun to do that. He really encourages them to call themselves DC. There had been Detective Comics and use this little logo and that had sort of already begun, but Marston really supported that because he wanted to brand the comics with an imprint of quality that would suggest that an editorial advisory board had actually said, this is good for kids. That's where that branding comes from. But he mainly says, look, the solution to all your problems is a girl. It's so simple. It's always true. Isn't it always true? So he just says, you know, the problem with these comic books is it's their blood-curdling masculinity. And so if you have a female superhero, she will embody the principles of love and truth and justice and beauty. She will be opposed to violence and opposed to war. She will stop bullets with her bracelets.
Wait, and give the background on the bracelets.
The bracelets Marston had given to Olive Byrne when they sort of sealed the deal to live together as a family. They were Olive Byrne's bracelets. I was giving a talk in Washington, D.C. last week, and one of Olive Byrne's granddaughters was there. And afterwards, she said, I have the bracelets. And I said, oh my God, I want to see the bracelets. You see them, and there's pictures in the book, the family photos. You always see suddenly Olive Byrne beginning this one year, she's wearing these bracelets all the time. And she has this lasso, golden lasso, anyone she ropes has to tell the truth, which is, you know, Marston's lie detector, obviously. But she's essentially a pacifist. She comes from this land of women, and she believes in women's equality, and that's what she's come to the United States to fight for.
Now, can we go back aside for a moment? Because once, it took a little bit of selling, but William Moulton Marston, he made a great case, what you need is a lady. Finally, DC Comics said, okay. And then the next thing was to figure out, who is this woman going to be, and what is she going to look like? And you see some of the early drawings there. Can you talk a little bit about the evolution of the look? Because it's fabulous. And why we never saw her wearing those sandals? Because Lord knows you cannot fight crime in heels like that.
No, you so could not. So this is this great sketch, and it's in the note on the left, Dear Dr. Marston, is from Peter, Harry G. Peter, the artist. And on the bottom and right is Marston's reply, Dear Pete. And they're agreeing that the sandals have to go. They look like a stenographer's, which is true. So once the publisher, M.C. Gaines, gives Marston permission for this experiment, he's going to try this for 6 months. Marston says, among the many things he stipulates, because remember, most of the people writing comics are teenagers, you know, and the artists are teenagers. And Marston's like, I'm going to hire my own artist. And here's this very old guy, Harry G. Peter. And commissions these initial drawings. It's right after Captain America has come out. Marvel, which used to be called Timely Comics, releases the first issue of Captain America in 1940. And Captain America, if you'll recall, is basically wearing an American flag. America's just about to enter the war. There's this real incredible surge of patriotism. So she clearly has to wear an American flag. I mean, she looks like girl Stephen Colbert. I always think. I could totally see him wearing this. Not the shoes. He would have the boots.
Which I'm just noticing, it says, the shoes look like a stenographer's. Yeah, that's a great little note.
Yeah. So this is their initial exchange, and the bracelets are really important to Marston. Now, there are a number of things that happen, and I don't have a slide for this, but one of the real influences on Wonder Woman's aesthetic, aside from she has to be super patriotic, she has to look like all-American and athletic and strong. But she has to look a little bit sexier than this, is I think what the publisher says. And Marston at the time had been a writer for Esquire magazine. Esquire started in 1933, and Esquire was Playboy before there was Playboy. And Esquire had in the 1940s these gorgeous centerfolds drawn by this Brazilian artist, Alberto Vargas. They're called the Varga Girls, if you've ever seen them. They're beautiful. I haven't seen that many because the bound volumes of Esquire magazine at Harvard, where I teach, I went and pulled them all off the shelves to look through the Varga Girls, and all you see is the razor slice on the spine where the Harvard undergrads have taken those Varga Girls home. But the Varga Girls, there's the high-heeled red boots that Wonder Woman gets instead of the stenographer's delicate shoes come from the kind of fetishy, kitschy, soft porn of Esquire. So Right. So this is, she gets these, but you can see the boots here. In the very beginning, she wears this skirt. They dispense with this skirt almost immediately. There's this fantastic, the very first episode of the Linda Carter Wonder Woman TV show, where her mother makes her mother Hippolyte, and the Paradise Island makes her dress, her outfit for her, and she has the skirt, and then she says, "I don't think I'll be needing this," and she takes it off to reveal her star-spangled underwear. So we can just look at these for a minute too, because another thing to say about Wonder Woman, I mean, from Marston's own, the story of his life, we know so much about how suffragists and feminists and early birth control activists influenced him and were indeed members of his family, but somehow we keep going forward here. We've jumped the shark there. But you can see in the visual representation of Wonder Woman that same influence, that is the influence of suffragism and feminism and the birth control movement. Here on the left is a Harry G. Peter panel of Wonder Woman doing what always she's doing, which is trying to escape from bonds of chains, which Marston always said, Wonder Woman always has to be chained up because she's an allegory for the emancipated woman. So she has to emancipate herself in every story. So in order for her to emancipate herself, we have to tie her up. And the publisher's like,
there's some other reasons that might work, huh?
There's some other reasons we might want to tie her up. Having to do with the boots. But here on the right is another drawing by Harry G. Peter, which makes that allegory quite clear. This is for an article that Marston wrote for American Scholar, a scholarly journal published by the Phi Beta Kappa Society. Marston always said Wonder Woman was an act of scholarship, a work of scholarship. So anyway, here you can see Harry G. Peter doing that same work, but making it making that allegory visible. And in the center is a completely typical suffrage cartoon from the 19-teens. Which you can see, obviously, the influence of that iconography in which suffragists for forever drawing women being tied up or chained up and breaking free of this. This is called tearing off the bonds. That until women gained the right to vote, they were essentially the slaves of men. And that we needed to represent women in this fashion in order to alert the world to the way in which the condition of being a disenfranchised woman was a condition of slavery. This drawing is done by a feminist cartoonist named Annie Lou Castor Rogers, who published as Lou Rogers because she was told she'd never get anything published if she didn't have a man's name. And she was a staff artist for Judge, which is a really important magazine in the 19-teens. So the reason I want to point that out is that Harry G. Peter was a staff artist for Judge in the 19-teens, too. Not only that, but he and Lou Rogers both contributed to Judge's regular pro-suffrage page, which was called The Modern Woman. It was in every issue, and it featured a cartoon in the center panel of every page. So Harry G. Peter was essentially a former suffrage cartoonist. He had never worked in comics when Marston hired him. He brought to that that job the qualification of knowing how to draw women fighting for the right to vote. So the biographical story of Marston illustrates that tie, but even Peter's own visual iconography and his own life helps us to see just how much Wonder Woman is, like, as I would argue, really the missing link in the history of feminism in the 20th century.
So while we have this slide up, I don't know if folks can read, but that first cell there, we see Wonder Woman chained up, and she says, "Men chained by my bracelets together, by Aphrodite's decree, my Amazon strength is gone." And so since we're at the Amazon and the Aphrodite and all this, let's talk a little bit about Wonder Woman's origin story and how that really infused her character all along.
Yeah, so the origin story that Marston wrote is that Wonder Woman lived on Paradise Island, that she was the daughter of Hippolyte, who came from Greece, ancient Greece, and had brought the Amazonian women of Greece to Paradise Island in order to live separately from men, blessed with eternal life in a world of peace. And this draws on the ancient Homeric sort of myth of the Amazons. And that all was wonderful, and of course it was a paradise because there were no men there. And then a U.S. military intelligence officer named Steve Trevor is in a dogfight with a Nazi spy in a plane flying over Paradise Island. He crashes to the island, and Princess Diana, the daughter of Hippolyte, finds him, and Hippolyte consults the gods, and she says, "You must bring this man back to America, the last hope for women's rights. And that's why Wonder Woman gets her star-spangled costume, which her mother makes for her, and gets in her invisible plane and flies away. The thing that's really important to me about that story, so I remember that story because I remember watching that episode of Wonder Woman, because it's Cloris Leachman who plays Prince, do you remember? The great Cloris Leachman plays Hippolyte. It's an incredible role. I remember that, and I remember reading it even in comics in the 70s. But when I went and reread it in the course of working on this book, I was like, wait a minute, I know that story. Because in between watching Linda Carter and Cloris Leachman reenact that story when I was a kid, and looking at this when I was much more than a grown-up, I went to college and I read feminist utopian fiction in women's studies classes like Charlotte Perkins Gilman's novel Herland, or the novel Angel Island. There are all these, it's actually a completely hackneyed form of fiction from the 1910s in which feminists write about these mythical lands where only women live, and they're free from war. They live eternally, but suddenly some man finds his way there, like a crew of American ship sailors are shipwrecked on Angel Island, and all the women are like, "What are we going to do with these people? They're going to be a problem for us because if we get too close to them, we're going to have children." But we're not sure we want that many children. And so a lot of these feminist utopian fictions are about the problem of birth control. Mm-hmm. So I had completely forgotten about that. But then, of course, then you see when you put those pieces together that Marston is just borrowing this plot line from feminist utopian fiction and importing it from the 19-teens into the 1940s, when those 8-year-olds who are down at the drugstore buying Wonder Woman, and they haven't read Herland either, so it looks new
right,
to them.
Right. Well, I was going to say, most of those 8-year-olds probably not familiar with those stories. So how did it go over? When Wonder Woman first hit the comic book stands, how much of a success was she?
She was a really big splash right away. I mean, she very quickly was, you know, a second only, or I guess third only to Superman and Batman. So there are a number of really obvious measures of her success. She's the only comic book superhero other than Batman and Superman to move from comic books to a comic strip. She becomes a comic strip in 1940. That doesn't last, but that mainly has to do with Marston getting polio. Marston and the publisher Gaines had made a deal that Wonder Woman would be a trial for 6 months, and then it would be put to the readers. This is the great age of the birth of the public opinion poll. George Gallup starts a polling company in 1935. So in 1942, Gaines is like, we're going to do a poll. We're going to do a public opinion poll. One of the questions Gallup had routinely asked starting in 1937 was, if a woman were otherwise qualified to be president of the United States, would you vote for her? I love the phrasing of that. Like, anyway, so Gaines sends out this questionnaire to readers, and it says, should Wonder Woman, even though a woman, be allowed to join the Justice Society?
Well, my favorite, I don't think we have a slide of that, but my favorite is that they were very clever, and I think this was Marston's idea, that they put Wonder Woman's photo twice. It was like this very subliminal tactic. Yeah. His psychology degree was probably worth
there's
a damn.
This, yeah, there's another questionnaire they send out, which is like, it's like six different superheroes, and they're all saying, they have like a speech bubble coming out of their mouth, they're all saying, vote for me to join the Justice Society. And then there's a ballot, like, which of us should be allowed to join the Justice Society? And, like, Wonder Woman's head is huge. And the other guys, who are like these fifth-rate losers, like Mr. Terrific, Little Boy Blue, The Gray Ghost, like these, like, total bench warmers. And then on the ballot itself, which you have to cut out of the page of the comic book, it's like, there's, like, another big head of Wonder Woman saying, fill in your name here. So Wonder Woman wins all these readers' polls and the election. And so she becomes a member of the Justice Society. She gets her own comic book in 1942, with Wonder Woman. And there's a big publicity blitz around that, which is actually quite interesting because Gaines has still been under a fair amount of criticism, and he's done this thing, he wants to celebrate this thing. And one of the things he launches with the first issue of Wonder Woman is a 4-page centerfold that appears in every issue that's called The Wonder Woman of History. Mm-hmm. And there are these feminist biographies, they're profiles of women of achievement. And he sends out the first issue of Wonder Woman to women all over the country, women of achievement, notable American women, with a cover letter from Alice Marble, who's this women's tennis champ.
And she says, you know, I'm going to be editing the Wonder Woman of history, and I would like to take nominations for who we should include. And it's this, you know, the reason we're publishing this comic book for girls is to show them that they can do anything, they can have any career, they can achieve whatever they want in athletics and sports and politics and the arts and literature and government. And that's what Wonder Woman is about, and help us make it the best that it can be. This is really kind of, obviously it's a publicity ploy, but it's not the bondage. It's a very different project. It's that other source of Wonder Woman. So, and those feminist biographies are actually pretty cool. You know, it's like, you know, it's Florence. It's your sort of stock figures. It's Florence Nightingale, Sojourner Truth, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Amelia Earhart, I think it's in there. But this is a really new thing, and a really new thing as a form of popular culture.
I want to fast forward a bit. As you mentioned, William Marston Moulton eventually contracts polio. He passes away. Wonder Woman lives on, but she's not quite the same. Talk a little bit about that chapter of her existence.
Yeah, so Marston dies in 1947, and the same year he dies, the publisher dies. Maxwell Charles Gaines is killed in a boating accident in Lake Placid. Joy Hummel, who was a very young girl who'd been a student of Marston's, who he had hired, who helped and wrote a lot of scripts between 44 and 47 when he was so ill. She's still alive. I interviewed her. She's amazing. She gets married, and her husband has a child. He's a widower from another marriage, and she decides to stay home with this little girl she falls in love with, so she quits. Sheldon Mayer, who had been the editor of Wonder Woman, also quits. He was just really sick of being an editor. So Wonder Woman is an orphan, and Marston's widow, Elizabeth Holloway Marston, writes this incredibly powerful letter to DC Comics in which she says, look, you know, I have known Bill Marston since I was 12. I've been a part of all of his work. I helped with the original lie detector test. You know, we went to law school together. We went to graduate school together. I've worked with him on all these projects all his life. I'm a very experienced and competent woman. She's had this incredible career. You should hire me as your new editor, and I will be sure to find great writers, but this story needs to stay in family hands, which is really interesting when you think about the way, and really it is a kind of family project. And the head of DC Comics, you know, says, no, and hires instead this guy, Bob Kaniger, as both writer and editor. And Kaniger really changes. He hates Wonder Woman as Marston's creation, and he sort of strips her of all of her powers, which is more or less just in line with what was going on in the culture at the time. I mean, so many women had gone to work in the 1940s when men were away fighting the war. Women who worked in the host of Rosie, there were women who worked in factories. During those years of the war, factories routinely provided childcare for women and paid them pretty well. Mm. So when men came home from the war, factories said, you know, you should go home too, to the women. But if women didn't want to stop working, they were forced out. The childcare centers were all closed and women's wages were dropped and you were just pressured to go back home. So what happens to Wonder Woman is she kind of retreats too, goes back into the home. And the way Kaniger writes her in the 1950s, she's just this sort of dopey, love-struck ballerina. Yes,
sad.
It's a little sad.
But we're going to fast forward a few more decades here. Along comes the 70s, and the women's lib movement starts to kind of gather steam once again, and so does Wonder Woman. What happened?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to look at a couple other slides here. Before Wonder Woman changes in the comic book, Wonder Woman is resurrected by women that loved Wonder Woman as children in the 1940s, as girls. So here on the left, in 1969, Gloria Steinem got her start in magazine publishing as a writer for New York Magazine. And this is an illustration that appeared in New York Magazine, drawn by Edward Sorrell in 1969. Sorry. And it's a little hard to see, but it's Wonder Woman as the liberated lady. The Y is missing. And it's in this issue, the liberated lady meets the smug liberal. And she's holding him over her head, and she's threatening him, and she's fighting to stop rape and catcalling. This is at a time when Wonder Woman, the comic book, has nothing to do with feminism, nothing whatsoever to do with feminism, but women in what is thought of as the second wave of the struggle for women's equality, these women's liberationists, have just turned to Wonder Woman as a kind of icon of their movement. This It Ain't Me, Babe comics is from a feminist collective of comic artists that's based in Berkeley, California. It's called the Women's Liberation Basement Press. And what they do in the first issue of It Ain't Me, Babe comics is resurrect all these stock women from comics from the 1930s, Olive Oil, Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, Lulu, and Wonder Woman, and they're marching in this protest of stock comic book plots. In this story inside, Veronica and Betty run away together. one of my favorite things is a story called Breaking Out. And then when Ms. Magazine publishes its first regular issue in 1942, they put Wonder Woman on the cover. So there's this incredible, fertile moment in the 60s and early 70s when Wonder Woman really becomes the icon for the women's liberation movement.
If we button it up there for a moment, yeah. If you go back to that Wonder Woman for President, yeah. Was something that William...
Yes, yeah, so there's this great... I didn't want to overwhelm you with slides, but Marston had put a storyline in which Diana Prince becomes president in a cartoon, in a comic book storyline in 1943, and the great cover says Wonder Woman for President. I just want to show a couple of other slides from the 70s. Inside that It Ain't Me, Babe comics where Veronica runs away with Betty, Lulu is told that she can't join a boys' club, and she she walks away. I just kind of love Lulu. Just losing it. It's my whole picture of feminism from 1970. It's just right there. And then I also love this. This is from L.A., so I included this here. This is a Los Angeles Women's Center. This is their regular newsletter. It's called Sister. One woman is on the cover wielding a speculum. And... with my speculum, I am strong and I can fight. And she's thwacking this guy. And inside, the whole inside of this is how to give yourself a vaginal self-exam. Which I just think is awesome. And this on the right is, it's from the New York Review of Books, but this actually appeared in a magazine called Family Planning Perspectives. It's Margaret Sanger dressed as Wonder Woman leaping off a diaphragm. So it makes you miss the 70s. Doesn't that make you miss the 70s? You're so over the top. They're all basically saying the same thing, which is what Lulu is saying. But the thing I love about the Sanger is, of course, nobody knew anything about the ties between Sanger and Wonder Woman. This is just purely coincidence. It's actually just because Sanger is an important figure, remains an important figure to second generation, to second wave feminists, and their icon is Wonder Woman. So therefore, they put Wonder Woman, Sanger in a Wonder Woman costume. But even at the time, like when Steinem put Wonder Woman on the cover of Ms. Magazine, they had to get permission from Elizabeth Holloway Marston, who was still living decades later. She had been living with Olive Byrne ever since. They were inseparable. Elizabeth Holloway Marston's invited to come to the offices of Ms. in New York, and she flies up from Virginia, where she's living with Olive Byrne. And she's so thrilled that all these exciting young women want to celebrate Wonder Woman. They're going to put the first issue of Ms. includes a pullout section of the original Marston comic books. Ms.'s big fundraiser that first year is a standalone volume of Ms. Publishes Wonder Woman. They're reproductions of the 1940s comics. They influenced this whole generation. Holloway Marston is incredibly excited about this. She never tells anybody a word about Olive Byrne. It's a complete secret. Everybody has been kept to secrecy. So even when a PhD student at Berkeley in 1974 is writing a dissertation about the history of Wonder Woman, and she tracks down Holloway Marston through Ms. Magazine, and she writes to her, and she says, I'm trying to figure out stuff about where things came from. Like, what about the bracelets? And Holloway Marston writes back, she says, oh, those... a student of Dr. Marston's used to wear those bracelets.
Well, and I have to say, to give that PhD student credit, one of my favorite parts of this book was reading. So Olive Byrne wrote all these articles about William Moulton Marston, and the way that she writes them, she talks about going to visit him and as if she has never met the guy. She's married to him and has children by him, yeah. And yet when she presents it in these articles, she presents it totally removed, totally third person. So this was a pretty deeply buried.
Yeah, I mean, all right, she's writing for Family Circle in 1935. She can't say, oh, we live in a threesome. That would be Family Triangle magazine. So, yeah, no, she's really committed. Because the thing about Olive Byrne, she's my favorite character in the whole story, yeah. Because she, there's this incredible sadness around these women that fight this fight for birth control a century ago. Ethel Byrne has two children in quick succession. Margaret Sanger has three children in quick succession. Their mother has died of tuberculosis after having, I think, 11 or 12 children. They both essentially leave their children to go become nurses and fight for birth control. So Ethel Byrne, her mother leaves her when she's 2 years old, leaves her and her brother. When she's born, her father throws her into a snowbank, and she's rescued by Margaret Sanger. Her father's drunk. He doesn't want children. He's too young. She has this incredibly difficult childhood growing up in Catholic orphanages and is rescued again and again by Margaret Sanger. But she, when Marston and his wife say, will you join our family and raise our children? She just wants to be in a family. I mean, yeah. She just wants to be in a family. She wants to have children. She's brilliant. She's probably the smartest of all of them. She really wants to have this family. And she doesn't want her children to grow up with an unconventional family life, because that's what she had. So she actually gives the children, her children, up for adoption to Marston and his wife. They're not even legally her children after a few years. I mean, she lives with them, but the family tells the world that she's like the housekeeper. It's her son, whose name is Byrne Holloway Marston, who's a retired obstetrician. And this is lovely. I mean, his grandmother was Ethel Byrne. There's this beautiful thing, I mean, about, you know, carrying on this tradition of caring for women. And he, you know, I asked him, you know, how he really thought about his mother. He said, it's like she was Jane Eyre, you know. I mean, there's this incredible sadness around her story. So, but, you know, Holloway's not trying to be sinister in not telling Gloria Steinem or this PhD student from Berkeley who Olive Byrne was. It really was important to Olive Byrne, above all, that it be kept a family secret.
I'm going to open up to questions from the audience in just a moment, but I'd like to ask you about something you don't really talk too much about in the book, which is this concept of a Wonder Woman. You look at all of the things that the feminists were fighting for in the 70s. They wanted women to be able to work at all jobs and get equal pay and all the rest of it. I would say that we haven't gotten the whole way there, but as they used to say in the Virginia Slims ads back in the day, we have come a long way, baby, right? And that term of a Wonder Woman, you hear bandied about. I mean, Louise just said it in the introduction to you tonight. And there's this notion of a Wonder Woman today as being the woman who does it all. She's got a couple kids. She's got a great job. She works really hard. She cooks dinner every night and walks the dog and makes the lunches. And she still somehow manages to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and take her spinning classes. There are lots of drugs, right? And there's the pressure, because it's impossible. It's impossible for any of us to be that Wonder Woman. And yet that image still exists. And Wonder Woman is the name that we use to describe that kind of person. Right. So what do you think, how far has she come? Like, is it, you know, where is this image and notion of a Wonder Woman today?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I bet people in the audience will have their own vantages to share about that in the form of a question. it became a big issue in the 1970s when Wonder Woman was really the icon of liberal feminists, right? For all those reasons, liberal feminism sort of advocated kind of individual achievement and individual accomplishment. I mean, that's an oversimplification, but radical feminists who were working for structural change as in the form of collectives and policy changes that would change the structure of society for all women and men, thought that Wonder Woman was a complete catastrophe, of complete betrayal of everything that feminism stood for, right? That it was all this emphasis on the individual, that the only way to actually triumph was to have superpowers. Like, what kind of equality is that? And I write in the book about, like, the problem with actually a superhero who fights for equality is like superheroes are better than everybody else. So if you have to be better than everybody else to fight for equality, you're not really fighting for equality. I think it's an incredibly complicated character. I'm sure we can look at one more slide before we. So there's this weird sort of weaponization of Wonder Woman in our contemporary cultural moment where every time you think about, like, how cool it is, this sort of allegorical woman fighting for her independence and equality with men, it somehow always devolves to, like, this thing. And that is really troubling, right? She's got to have guns. Like, she was a pacifist who was supposed to be opposed to guns. Like, okay, characters change. The comic book characters are updated all the time. But there's this kind of entropy problem with feminist icons that they, or with female icons, that they devolve into the pornographic and into the ultra-violent. And So as a visual icon, there are all kinds of issues around that. I mean, there's issues really complicated. That said, though, like most things, these things kind of go two different ways. So I am really continually struck by talking to women, you know, our age, who really, like, it really meant something to them that there was a TV show on when they were kids where a woman was stronger than the men and where she, like, helped people out. And I told this story recently about, I have only boys, and although they're quite tolerant of Wonder Woman because it makes a good present for a mom on her birthday, when what else are they going to get me? It's a Wonder Woman action figure. I have girls in the house all the time because we have friends over all the time. And when just a few weeks before the book came out, I had some friends over who are foster parents, and I was hanging out at the kitchen table with this 8-year-old girl who's in foster child, really difficult, really, really difficult life. And we had taken out, we were looking for stuff in the kitchen. Like, I only have boy stuff. So she was like, what are we going to play? And I had this box of postcards that are DC Comics original, DC Comics covers from the 1940s and 30s. And we pulled them out, and so we were just spreading them all over the kitchen table. And she pulled out all of them, and I just watched her do this. I was, like, drinking my coffee. She's like, she pulls out each of the ones that are Wonder Woman and puts them in this separate pile. Then she starts ordering them. And then she's asking me 1,000 questions, like, what are the bracelets for? Why does she, what does she do with that lasso? What about the tiara? Why does she have that tiara? And she had asked a few questions about, like, whatever, the Flash and a couple of, like, Green Lantern, and she's like, ah. And then... She just looks at me and she says, she is so strong and she can rescue people. And so I get bummed out about the sort of soft porn nature of these icons, and the radical feminist critique has a lot of cred to it. But for an 8-year-old girl to see a woman who can rescue people, that is a great gift.
And with that, thanks to Joe Lepore. If you have a question, please raise your hand, and one of these two lovely ladies with microphones will head your way.
How do you think it would be different if he hadn't died in 1945?
47.
Uh-huh. What do you think that, how would Wonder Woman be different today in 2014 if he were, you know, still here?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't think really that different. I don't think he would have done it for that much longer, to be honest. He had already begun. It was kind of too much work for him to handle because she was appearing and she was so popular. She was in many different comic books. She had her own comic book. She had a newspaper strip. She was in Sensation Comics. She was in All-Star Comics. She was in Comic Cavalcade. She was just kind of all over the place. And he had already hired an assistant, and he in the 1940s, Marston had his oldest son was a freshman at Harvard and would send comic book stories home to him. Like, he just kind of was running out of ideas. And there's only so many ways to tie a woman up and have her break free. Although, actually, people are still at that, and the people who write Hollywood screenplays. This is a kind of Dudley Do-Rightism that just only takes you so far. So I think he'd become a little tired of it, and it would have been more of a farmed out collective project in any case. And what happens to the character has to do with changes in women's economic role and the sort of the culture's willingness to tolerate a woman being so strong. There was a great deal of excitement about that and a need for that during the war. It's really more about the end of the war ultimately than it is about Marston's death. I mean, that has a much greater impact on what kinds of stories are possible.
Yes, there is another character in the story that you haven't talked about tonight, Huntley. The other woman, and sorry, there's this character that it's very interesting, enters their life very early on and comes in and out of their lives, but she seems to be in all the pictures almost, and have you got anything else to say about her that didn't go into the book? Or is there something that you think that you couldn't say as a scholar, but that...
that I'll say here? For television, so...
How does she get into the story, in a way of one?
Yeah, if you don't tweet about it, I'll tell you anything. The question is about this woman named Marjorie Wilkes Huntley, who is really, truly fascinating. So she is a kind of a dynamo of a woman, but very mysterious. She and Marston meet in 1918 when he is stationed at, I forget what the name of the military site where he's stationed, but she's the librarian at this military camp when he's serving in the First World War. And he's fascinated by her because she has these really interesting ideas about psychic powers. Now, it may seem odd that Marston was attracted to someone who believed she was a psychic, but if you remember, like William James, who's a real founder of psychology and a nice great philosopher and psychologist, William James, who's also a physician, he believed in he believed that the dead could speak across the afterlife and did all kinds of experiments to prove this. His field of psychical research was quite big. James didn't die till 1909. One of the last experiments he did involved a seance trying to use the powers of an occultist. It was a very powerful idea in American psychology and in European psychology throughout the 19-teens. And so Marston was fascinated by Marjorie Wilkes Huntley in the same reason that William James was fascinated by all these people who claimed to be psychics and who led seances. I don't know what their relationship was. Most of the people I interviewed in the family don't think that they were ever lovers. I myself am a little skeptical about that claim. She didn't have children with him, but she also had a hysterectomy, and I don't know why. I don't know if that was medically required, if that was some kind of a choice. There's this very, I think, quite troubling photograph in the book that I found in a family album where the three women are sitting on a bench in a garden in their house in Rye, New York, which is funny because it's like this tree leafy suburb of New York City, and where they all live. Huntley lives with them throughout the 1930s. I mean, on and off. She lives in the attic. And Olive Byrne, who really did not like Huntley, would always say, you know, there are bats in the belfry. Like, she thought she was nuts. But there's a picture in it, and it's from 1932, and Elizabeth Holloway Marston is holding her new baby, her second baby, Olive Ann. She's named their daughter after Olive Byrne. And Olive Byrne is holding her second son, Don, same age. They're about 6 months apart. And Marjorie Wilkes Huntley is holding a little rag doll. and it's funny, creepy. because she didn't have children and because she died alone in a nursing home, this actually, as a historian, the worst thing you want to hear about somebody that you were interested in is that they didn't have children and that they died alone in a nursing home. Because where are the papers? Where are the photographs? Where is anything? Who do you talk to? One grandchild from the family said she was pretty certain that Huntley had burned all of her papers because they were so radical. And I found other evidence that she had done so. There's a lot of belief in the occult and psychic powers and this love sphere and reading minds in Wonder Woman comics. Most of that comes by way of Marjorie Wilkes Huntley. She worked as a librarian for most of her life. I found, fascinatingly, the most interesting document of Huntley's I found was in Gloria Steinem's papers, which are uncatalogued but are at Smith College, and I just poured through them, and the archivist helped me find stuff that might be useful. She writes in 1972 asking for a subscription, and she's completely excited about Ms. Magazine, and she signs her letter, Marjorie Wilkes Huntley, Ms.
That's great.
If you could say anything to the filmmakers working on the Wonder Woman movie right now, what would that be?
What would you say? All right, how many people think there should be more Wonder Woman in that movie? Oh, it's so limited. Okay.
No. Because here, can I tell you the latest from Hollywood? Because okay. I was curious because this film now Warner Brothers is saying it's going to come out in 2017, and I just read today, this was really fascinating, that there is a female director who they approached for this, who I guess had directed another comic book film, which someone out here probably knows the title of. I can't recall it. And Warner Brothers hadn't specifically officially reached out to her yet, but there have been a lot of rumors swarming that, oh, she'd be the perfect fit. She's a woman. She's a director. She's in a comic book movie. She should do Wonder Woman. And she said, oh, hell no. I don't want to have anything to do with that movie. I said, well, why? And she said, it's too much pressure. She says, no matter what I do, uh-huh. I will never be able to do her enough justice. And they're going to look at it and say, well, that's just more one more indication that women can't really direct in Hollywood. And I just, my heart just kind of sank when I read that. So, yeah.
So they find a filmmaker.
That story is this for the first standalone Wonder Woman movie, which is supposed to come out in 2017. But this movie called Batman versus Superman: Dawn of Justice is supposed to come out in 2016. I thought you were asking about the Dawn of Batman versus Superman: Dawn of Justice. Or were you asking about the standalone Wonder Woman movie? Both. But now I throw that still back to you. When I said, should there be more Wonder Woman in Batman versus Superman? I think the answer is yes. I find it fascinating how Wonder Woman has been dropped out of the Justice Society in that way. I mean, I'm not a comic book purist. I don't follow these things. But people will say, like, why has it taken so long? There have been 8 Batman movies and 7 Superman movies. Why has there not been a Wonder Woman? What is the problem with these people? And then there are all these interesting counterfactuals posed, you know, or explanations that are offered. Well, she has these, you know, kind of mythic... it's just a mythic backstory. That would be difficult. Like Thor. She wouldn't update so well. Captain America, they just froze him. Like, it's just really not that. Like, none of these objections are sustainable. I wrote an article about Wonder Woman for The New Yorker. It's called The Last Amazon. And I had really wanted to go watch some of the filming of the Batman versus Superman movie because I thought that would be so fun to report on. But the set was closed and they wouldn't let me in. So I did a poor man's version of that reporting job, which was I took Bern Holloway Marston to go see Captain America 2. Because my plan was he and I were going to go see the filming together, and we were going to bring his sister-in-law, whose name is Margaret Sanger Marston, because Margaret Sanger's granddaughter married Olive Byrne's son, Don. The family's married together because Olive Byrne worked as Margaret Sanger's secretary at the end of Sanger's life, so the families became closer together. The children of the next generation. So I wanted to bring Margaret Sanger Marston and Bern Holloway Marston to go see Superman versus Batman being filmed. And they wouldn't let us in, which is too bad. It would have been fun. but I just kind of wanted to call attention to that cross-generational, that these were long stories that were carried forward, even these people's names. So Bern and I, we went to go see Captain America 2. And it got me really thinking about what happens. Captain America starts in 1940, the way the Marvel people dealt with the problem that he's just this like earnest Boy Scout and he seems very dated and he wears an American flag that he would be harder to update because apparently the selling thing is that everybody has to be moody and depressed. So like you have to be a depressed Superman and a depressed, well, Batman kind of is depressed, but Superman's become depressed. Like all these superheroes have to have this like kind of, even like Iron Man is kind of depressed. Like they're all just basically suffering from depression. So, you can't have like a Captain America who needs anti-depression. He's on Prozac like from the start. So they couldn't really figure out what to do about Captain America. So they had him frozen in 1945, and then he wakes up in the movie in the Captain America franchise. This is for those of you who haven't seen any of these movies. He wakes up, and then the whole joke, the jokiness of the Captain America movies is a set of anachronism that this engenders. So. People are always asking him, like, hey, well, you know, what's good about now versus then? And he's like, well, I don't know. No polio is good. Or there's a scene where Scarlett Johansson says to him, you know, what did you do Saturday night? And he said, nothing. Everyone in my barbershop quartet is dead. But it's fun. Like, it's very playful about the anachronism. And the big thing about the second Captain America movie is he's very pro-American, but in the second Captain America movie, he discovers what amounts to sort of the NSA's surveillance scheme, and he becomes kind of anti-American, and he wants to sort of fight the NSA, and it's a really complicated thing for him as a World War II, as a sort of frozen World War II Boy Scout. How would that person in 2011 you know, think about the NSA's surveillance programs or something. So it's kind of interesting, right? But if you were to do that thing in the article, I say this more economically, I promise, if you were to read it, In the article, because I was sitting there with Vernon, we were talking about this, Vern Marston. What would happen if they had frozen Wonder Woman in 1941? And she wakes up and it's 2014 and she's like, okay, the Equal Rights Amendment was introduced in 1923. That's not funny. It's not funny. I'm laughing, but not a lot. So that's one thing you couldn't do if you were writing the story, right? One thing that comic book people tell me that they have done is that the comics books have changed the backstory. So they got rid of the whole Amazonian backstory, and Wonder Woman is now the daughter of Zeus, which, okay, it just makes no sense whatsoever. Like, she is a character whose origins come from feminism of the progressive era and feminist utopian fiction. Like, she's not a Percy Jackson character.
As a lawyer and as somebody who married into the comic book industry about a quarter of a century ago, the part of this story that I have found, I find interesting and I haven't been able to find enough information about is what the Marston family got versus what, say, Siegel and Shuster's families got in terms of creators' rights, which, because he was an older man who obviously knew something about intellectual property, was a whole lot better than the teenage boys who created Superman. And what did you learn about this?
Yeah. So for people who didn't marry into the comic book industry and aren't lawyers, Siegel and Shuster created Superman, and there has been a series of lawsuits, pretty much sort of like the Jarvis v. Jarvis of American history. The series of lawsuits going into, I think, their seventh decade at this point, because they were paid very scantily, and their heirs have sued the entity that later became DC Comics is now DC Entertainment. I don't think those suits have ever been finally resolved. Marston wrote his own contract in 1941. I have not seen the contract. It lies outside the scope of my interest, and is a private legal document. DC Comics and the Marston family have very good relations, and that I think has been really important to both of them over the years. I think that Elizabeth Holloway Marston was something of a challenge to that. Members of her family talk about that one of her granddaughters said that every time Marston's widow showed up in New York, the guys at DC Comics would hide under their desks. They were terrified of her. She was also an attorney, and she had practiced as an attorney for a lot longer than Marston had. So she took very good care of that estate. Olive Byrne's son, Don, the one who married Margaret Sanger's granddaughter, he was also a lawyer, and he handled the estate. So the estate was handled by Marston until his death and by his widow, who was an attorney. She didn't die till 1993. She died at the age of 100. But long before she died, her adopted son, Don Marston, took over the estate. And so I don't know anything about the family arrangements, nor is it any of my business. But certainly it has not been an adversarial or acrimonious situation so far as I know. But I don't know.
This may be a stupid question, but what is the Justice Society?
Yes. No, it's not a stupid question. The Justice Society is a league of superheroes that was formed by All American Comics, which was the comic book company that M.C. Gaines owned. It was formed in 1940, and with its own comic book called All-Star Comics. And it was a way to take superheroes that existed in other comic books. Maybe they had their own comic books, or maybe they were made guest appearances in certain other heroes, and to kind of try them out in their own comic book and see if they had any staying power, or to reward superheroes that had a big following by bringing them in. It was just a gimmick, but they're a little bit like the League of Nations. I mean, they're modeled on these international cooperative bodies, and Superman and Batman are kind of honorary members, and Wonder Woman is elected as a member in 1942. The stories that are about involving the Justice League and that are published in All-Star Comics are not written by the guys who write the books that those characters regularly appear in. They're written by this guy, Gardner Fox, most of them. And so Marston had no control over what happened to Wonder Woman when she entered the Justice Society and she was in those stories. And unfortunately, Gardner Fox was not as interested in Wonder Woman's many talents, and he decided that the role of the only female member of the Justice Society was that she should be the secretary. So if the question was, what should Wonder Woman do in Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice? Let us hope that she is not the secretary. Thanks very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.